Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Sea swimming season is almost upon us again. Some bathers are wary of swimming on beaches near to where seals congregate. However, there's little cause to be concerned. That's my belief, anyway. While I've had several close encounters with seals during my regular swims at the 40-foot in County Dublin down the years, my experiences have been uneventful. It's never been more than a curious seal pup playfully twisting and turning below me, or the occasional adult popping its head above the surface to see who's intruding on his trusted corridor to Bullock Harbour. By showing seals the respect they deserve and keeping your distance, by and large, everything ends up swimmingly. So says my friend and neighbour, Mark Leslie. Mark is a seasoned sea swimmer and seal aficionado. Mark cherishes being underwater filming a plump of seals. It's why his fellow swimmers in Sandy Cove call him the Seal Whisperer. Mark assures me he's on first name terms with what he calls the Wawu tribe, a moniker he coined for the local herd of seals whose HQ is Dalkey Island. If Mark is not down at the 40-foot for his early morning dip, chances are he's over by the old baths, where sub-aqua divers gather at weekends, exploring the depths with his seal friends in Scotsman's Bay. He calls it the Seal Garden. There he swims with Beamish, Doris et al., amid the green and orange fields of kelp. Other less energetic seals take to the nearby rocks, lazing in the sun and rolling about in slow motion. The Seal Garden is also a ballroom of romance for those in search of their ration of passion. Once Juliet adopts a banana pose and gets a little frisky on the rocks, Romeo knows it's time for action. When the deed is done, the couple perform a victory swim. They breach the surface of the water and jump into the air to let their Wawu colleagues know they had a whale of a time. How easy is it to tell the seals apart? Well, when it comes to a bull or cow, size and shape determines that. A bull like Beamish is stout, dark, and has a white snout. Doris is, well, a lady just like Doris Day. But how does the Seal Whisperer separate Doris from Brona, and Brona from Speckles? Mark tells me it's down to body markings and personality, how they behave in the water. The local herd of grey or harbour seals at Dalkey Island numbers around 50. They swim to and from Sandy Cove in channels, occasionally stopping off at Bullock Harbour for a snack. They can spend up to 30 minutes submerged. Mark understands why people might be nervous around seals. They are put off by how big they are in the water, particularly a bull, and how fast they move. Seals are territorial. Pups are highly inquisitive and find the actions of humans intriguing. It's advisable to avoid a cow when she has young alongside her in the water. As with any wild animal, if you're unfortunate enough to be bitten, even slightly, it's important to get a tetanus vaccine as a seal's mouth is alive with bacteria. Can bathers and seals safely share the sea? First and foremost, Mark insists, people must remember that the ocean is the seal's home, and they know it. Having said that, should you find yourself close to a seal when bathing, move slowly. Stop in the water and face the seal like you would a dog. Don't turn your back and never kick out or make physical contact with a seal. If it's a beach or bathing area like the 40-foot, where seals are close by, one safeguard would be for swimmers to wear goggles, fins, or a pair of booties. Being the clever mammals they are, seals are aware of bathers and the gear they wear in the sea. By wearing goggles, you get to witness the wonder of a grey seal navigating the depths. Mark is convinced that any intentions seals have in relation to bathers are benign. They have incredibly sharp teeth, he says. If they wanted to be hostile to humans, they could wreak havoc, but they generally don't. So I'd share Mark's advice to anyone swimming in the sea this summer. Enjoy the company of seals. Be amused by their presence, but please don't seek them out.
A shadow rose from out the sea, cradling a newborn.
Search for a lady
to nurse the babe for 7 years till he returns from whence he came. Though this wee boy's heart be cold.
Last autumn, we visited a rice farm near Vercelli, that's in the Po Valley, where over 50% of Europe's rice and almost all its risotto rice comes from. This particular farm was the setting for the 1949 film Riso Amaro, usually translated as bitter rice, though it's also a pun on bitter laughter. In the past, until mechanisation took over, rice in Italy was planted and harvested by women known as le mondine. The word comes from the verb mondare, which means to cleanse or peel, because among their other tasks, they cleaned the rice fields of weeds. The women came from all over Italy for the rice season, 25,000 of them at the peak of production, and returned home afterwards, bringing their hard-earned wages to poorer regions. Needless to say, it was back-breaking work, and they spent the daylight hours up to their knees in water that was full of snakes, rats and leeches, and surrounded by clouds of blood-sucking mosquitoes. They sang songs as they worked, many of which were of the call-and-response form. The role of lead singer passed around from woman to woman, and often they invented new verses to record the events of the day. Since the workers were forbidden to talk, a rule enforced by male capos, who could punish them by deducting wages or reducing food, and in some instances beating them, this singing amounted to a form of illicit conversation. They sang of everything in their lives, their families waiting for them at home, their boyfriends, husbands and children, love, politics, the work in the fields, and their struggle for unionisation and a better life. And the women didn't take their oppression lying down. Already in the late 19th century, they had begun to organise. The song La Lega, the League, begins with the lines, Se ben che siamo donne, paura non abbiamo. Even though we are women, we have no fear. You can hear this song towards the end of Bernardo Bertolucci's wonderful film Novecento, or 1900. And they were indeed fearless. Strikes and other forms of agitation for better conditions and wages were often put down with brutal force by gangs operating for the bosses and even by the police and army. But the women fought on anyway, and they did win concessions. In 1903, the Cantelli regulations ordered that their work should begin not earlier than 1 hour after sunrise and end not later than 1 hour before sunset, that their bedding and shelter should be clean and comfortable, that the owners should provide them with clean water and sufficient food, and that no children under 13 could be employed in the rice fields. These regulations did not, however, apply everywhere and were widely ignored by the owners. Troublesome workers were fired, union organisers were beaten up or even killed. The owners, the hated padroni, tried to starve the strikers into submission. But strikes continued nevertheless, often involving the entire Po Valley and therefore the entire rice production of Italy. And eventually the government stepped in to regulate the work. Among the songs the women sang was one called Le 8 ore, the 8 hours, an account of the harsh conditions the women worked under and a demand for what seemed impossible at a time when farm workers traditionally worked all the hours of daylight, an 8-hour working day. The women rice workers of Vercelli did win the 8-hour day, and it became law in 1909, 10 years before it became law for other workers in Italy. There are many other beautiful songs that the women sang, like Amore mio non piangere, My love do not cry, but the best known song to come out of this terrible way of life has to be Bella Ciao. We know it now in the form that developed among the partisans during World War II. now the official song of resistance all over the world. But it originates among the Mondine, the rice workers. The definitive version is that by Giovanna Daffini, an Italian folk singer who sang it with authority, having herself worked as a Mondina as a young woman. In the song, a girl wakes up and remembers that again today she must go to work in the risaia and face the brutal labour, the mosquitoes and the capo with his truncheon. She goes on to describe the misery of the working day. The words are both lyrical and heartrendingly direct. Oh, mamma mia, oh, che tormento. Hardly needs translation. The song ends, however, on a defiant note. The day will come, the woman says, when everyone will work together in liberty. Many, even most folk songs, have an international life cycle. Interestingly, the air of Bella Ciao is believed by some music critics to have developed from an even earlier Yiddish song, the first recorded example of which comes from Ukraine. It's appropriate that an air that may have begun in Ukraine, that was adapted to the struggle of women workers for their rights, and subsequently evolved into a hymn of resistance to fascism, should now come full circle to be sung again in Ukraine as a gesture of defiance against Putin's invasion. The last verse of the Mondine song comes to mind. The day will come, they sing, when all of us will work together in liberty. Verrà il giorno che tutte quante lavoreremo in libertà. Bring on the day.
Alla mattina, appena alzata, oh bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, 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 alla mattina, appena alzata, in risaia mi tocca andare.
I love islands. I love their sense of enclosure and completeness and isolation. I've spent time on several islands off our coast, but many years ago I had a day trip with a difference. My sister and her husband, both architects living across the Atlantic, phoned to say that on their next trip home, they'd like to visit Lambay Island, and could I arrange it? Sure, I said, without really knowing how to do it. Their interest was less in the island itself, but more in the work of Sir Edwin Lutyens, the architect who designed some buildings there. Lambay Island lies 5 kilometres off the east coast of Ireland, just north of Dublin City. It's about 2 square kilometres in size and is owned by the Baring family of banking fame. While it's possible for the public to visit it nowadays, back in the early 90s this wasn't the case. So, what to do? I decided to write to the then owner, Rupert Baring, otherwise known as Lord Revelstoke. I had heard him variously described as a recluse and an eccentric, so I didn't fancy my chances. However, I employed my most creative writing skills and wrote him a jaunty little note explaining that, personally, I couldn't tell a Gandon from a gondola, but that I had in-laws and friends who were passionate about architecture, and Lutyens in particular. Would it be possible to visit his island home? His reply was prompt and positive. He would send a boatman to meet us at Rogerstown Pier in North County Dublin. On the day in question, a bright, cold April morning with a deep blue sky, a small group of architects and I shared our boat with 9 sheep, who were making the crossing at the same time. We could see a row of white Coast Guard cottages near the harbour as we approached, and the mound of island behind them. With appropriate good manners, we let the sheep disembark first and waited for Eileen, Lord Revelstoke's assistant, who would take us up to the house. The architect Edwin Lutyens, born in 1869 to an English father and Irish mother, was a good friend of the Baring family, in particular Maud and Cecil Baring, who bought the island in 1904, having seen an ad in the London papers. The island's main building at that time was a 16th century castle in need of renovation. For this project, the Barings called on their good friend Lutyens. The shy but convivial architect's great skill was to modernise old structures without spoiling their ancient beauty. We emerged from the harbour pier to a series of terraces which led upwards past the whitewashed cottages to the sheep-shorn grass of an open meadow. In front of us stood a high stone rampart wall. Within the walls, we were greeted by so many daffodils bowing and nodding that they would inspire even the most reluctant poet. The house itself was grey, with windows peeping out from beneath roof tiles, which swept down low like a girl's overlong fringe in danger of obscuring her eyes. Inside, Eileen let us wander about, and my impression was of a labyrinth of corridors, with a surprise at every turn. A spiral limestone staircase, a glimpse of the vaulted drawing room. We were in the kitchen with its whitewashed walls, long oak ceiling beams, unvarnished floors scrubbed pale silver, and all about, antique blue and white Delftware. I was impatient to meet the owner. Just when we thought he was taking the recluse business to extremes, Eileen explained that his lordship was unwell, but that he hoped to meet us briefly later. While the others made sketches and took photographs, I noticed that, scattered around his home, in frames and in notebooks, were the writings of Lord Revelstoke, including a tribute to his mother which would warm any mother's heart, along with several humorous rhymes. I felt now I was gleaning a sense of this man's personality. Sadly, we never did get to meet his lordship, as he remained bedridden with the flu. In my thank you note to him some weeks later, I decided to write to him in verse. 'Twas on a Monday morning, the wind was blowing mean, we set off for Lambay, were met by sweet Eileen. I figured this would amuse him, as indeed it did. He replied to me in similar vein, a handwritten 16-line rhyme, which included much self-deprecation. Your friends made drawings of the art, and spent their time in bliss, while you, my dear, enjoyed your part by writing junk like this. His poem was signed Rupert Revelstoke. Unfortunately, our rhyming correspondence was short-lived, as Rupert Baring, 4th Baron Revelstoke, died in July the following year. One of his obituaries mentioned his verse writing, saying that Sir John Betjeman, poet laureate, had called it good doggerel. Now, I think, while I may not have glossy architectural coffee table books in my home, at least I do have some good doggerel in a frame on my wall.
The sea is quite rough. We sail out around Lambay. Untie the tight lines, it's time to heave away. The sun is quite high, the deck's slowly drying. Hoist up the big white sail.
In the spring of 1970, we swapped the smog-drenched streets of West London for the wilds of West Kerry. I was the youngest of four boys, all under the age of 10. My older brothers disappeared into the fields and onto the beaches of this new and vast playground. We rented a farmhouse while our bungalow neared completion. Our new house sat on a slight hill overlooking the bay, where lights twinkled in the distance when the sun descended. Later that summer we moved in. My mother was apprehensive, though, because all was not that simple. We had a near neighbour. Well, when I say near, what I really mean is that he lived at the bottom of our garden. Bill was his name, and his tiny white house was tucked in behind a cluster of crabapple trees in what the deeds proved to be a separate plot. Bill was a tall, thin, bespectacled man, and he wore a long beige trench coat with a beige beret to match. When he first set eyes on the young English tearaways, his face turned even greyer. "I'm ruined," he declared. "I'm completely ruined." My father assured him that we'd keep our distance, but Bill remained wary. He ordered a wall to be built around his little house. Within weeks, he was barricaded in by a high white wall with a narrow crevice at its centre. This gap allowed him to slip in and out with ease, yet he seldom did. As that first summer fell into autumn, sightings of Bill were as rare as the sunlight itself. But when the winter loomed, he appeared again like an animal having gained an extra layer of fur. His winter garb consisted of a long black coat that touched his toes and a black beret now that hid the white hairs growing out of his ears. There were only two places Bill could be found: at the nearby Bay Hotel having dinner, or wandering the Strand Road to the beach below. He had been a teacher, or at least that's what my father heard, and he'd been sacked by the local parish priest amidst rumours of drink. Then he took off up the country somewhere, disappeared for years. Some said he went to England and fought for king and country, but the truth is nobody seemed to know much about the man. When the weather brightened, he began to appear again, back in beige attire, but looking even thinner now. My mother sensed his frailty, and I'm not sure when or how it exactly happened, but my father began bringing him his breakfast, and in the fading evening light, we'd place a dish of bread on his wall, but never went any further. We called out, "Bill!" before hearing his door open. Soon after, his bony old hands appeared, and like a bird, he carried the bread back into the nest before disappearing inside again. On warm days, he began sitting in a sun trap outside the wall. "The heat eases the pains," he'd say. He and my parents chatted more frequently. What they'd chat about, I'd no idea. But sometimes I heard the word doctor and hospital being mentioned in whispers, of course. I can still see my father helping this feeble old man into our black Volkswagen Beetle. I can still see the reg plate, JIE15. Still smell the fumes as it takes off towards the town. I wondered if we'd ever see Bill again. But some hours later there he was, in the passenger seat, as the car pulled up. They wanted to keep him in, but he wouldn't stay in, I heard my father say before he walked the ailing Bill to the wall's crevice, but went no further as usual. The bread was collected untouched from the wall each morning thereafter. The bird was surely facing his final hibernation. Now I'm following my mother through the garden and beyond the crevice of Bill's wall. She slowly turns the handle of his front door. I'm finally going to see what's inside. And seconds later, through the darkness, I see another door. It's a caravan. Bill has a caravan inside his house. How on earth did he get it in there? The curious child wonders. My mother keeps me back, and all I can see is Bill's legs. Bill's lying on the bed. "I'm dying, Joe. I'm dying," he cries over and over. "Shush now, Bill," she whispers. "Shush now." I don't remember an ambulance coming or how he was taken away, but days later, Bill died in the old Dingle Hospital. His parting words to my father: "Whatever I have now is yours, Sean. I'll have no more use for it." It was fitting that my father was the man to knock the walls that Bill had built around himself. For I doubt Manny got as close to Bill as he did. We broke down the gable and pulled the caravan back out into the light. It was cleaned and painted and passed on, with the ghost of Bill still inside, no doubt. His little white house still stands at the bottom of the family garden, still known as Bill's house. Bill the man in the beret. Bill like a bird who flitted in and out of his nest for crumbs. Bill who remains as much a mystery to us now as he did then.
Of sunlight to moonlight.
I was introduced to beekeeping by the father of a good friend of mine. He was a retired military man who, when he spoke about bees, shifted into a curious and mysterious world occupied by queens, drones, workers, propolis, frames, smokers, an entire glossary of words with which he sought to convey the fascinating, ordered chaos of the hive to me. I was smitten. My beekeeper friend suggested that if I were really interested, I should attend a course in beekeeping. Encouragingly, he added that if I completed the course, he'd give me a hive. Who could resist such an offer? I located a course for beginners run by the Dublin Beekeepers Association. It seemed appropriate that the instructor was a cleric named Brother Bean. And 8 weeks later, after a crash course in beekeeping basics, which led me infinitely further into that magical universe, I was given a certificate and a blessing, the former of which I proudly took with me to my mentor's home as proof of having fulfilled my part of the bargain. He seemed a little surprised, but pleased, and, true to his word, he went out to his shed and returned with the main components of a beehive, minus bees. During the following weeks, I acquired a nucleus, or starter population, of bees, and went through the terrifying excitement of installing them in that first beehive. And so began many happy years of beekeeping, with my mentor always at the end of the telephone, should I need his advice. Sadly, about 15 years later, my beekeeper mentor passed away. His family contacted me to let me know that he'd hoped that I would inherit his bees, as no one in the family was keen on doing so. For those unfamiliar with beekeeping, the offer of two hives filled with bees at the beginning of summer is like gold dust. Beekeepers dream of such moments. So one May evening, I set off to collect the hives. Transporting beehives isn't an unusual practice. Beekeepers often move their hives from location to location to gather pollen and nectar from different plants as the honey flow progresses throughout the seasons. The hives are usually and preferably transported in an upright position. My problem was that the hives were of the large WBC kind, as they're known, the ones with the big pitched roof that you often see in photographs, but which are, at least nowadays in Ireland, rarely used as they're so heavy and cumbersome. It was immediately clear to me that they wouldn't fit standing upright in my low-roofed estate car. Thinking myself resourceful, I decided to seal the hive entrances with foam sponge and strap the various sections of the hive very tightly together before laying them horizontally in the back of my car. With a lot of strenuous heaving, which had to be done alone as my mentor's family were bee sting intolerant, I manoeuvred the heavy hives through the garden and then placed them as gently as possible into the car. I set off across Dublin to my home in Harold's Cross, a gentle, contented hum emanating from the rear of my car. I passed through Clontarf and Merino, and the buzzing seemed to get louder. In Fairview, the traffic grew heavy. The now distressed-sounding buzzing of up to 100,000 agitated bees grew in intensity. And it was then I heard the first bee alarmingly close to my right ear. I waved my hand at it. Then again. Suddenly, there were two or more bees in my sight and flying close to my head. I swatted again. This time, a driver stuck in traffic going in the opposite direction waved back. As the traffic inched forward, more bees escaped the hives till a loud, cacophonous buzzing pulsated throughout the car. Bees were hitting the windscreen, landing on my arms and head, while I tried to fend them off. Meanwhile, more surprised but friendly drivers waved at me. By the time I reached the customs house, the interior of my car was a cloud of agitated bees. That's when they began to sting. My ankles, my arms, my shoulders all fell victim. I considered bailing out and simply abandoning the car, but the prospect of that humiliation prevented me. So, resigning myself to the pain, I continued driving and waving all the way across the Liffey, along the quays, up under the arch of Christ Church Cathedral, past St. Patrick's, and onto Harold's Cross. I can't recall how many times I was stung, nor how many passing motorists and pedestrians crossing the road waved back, some very energetically, mirroring my own frantic gestures. Arriving home, I realised that what had to be done immediately. I leaped from the car, my head and clothes a tangled veil of escapees, and opened up the rear door. Another wave of bees stormed out. I could see that the strapping had loosened and allowed the bees to escape. I slid the hives out and erected them vertically beside the car, and then carried them one by one into my garden and stood them in their new resting places. If the neighbours had looked out of their windows, they would have seen a man frantically tearing off his clothes, running towards the back door, naked by the time he got there, his arms spinning like windmills. Perhaps they would have waved back. As for the bees, they settled in quickly, and by the next day they were discovering new flight paths to sources of pollen and nectar to create many golden harvests over the years. Reward enough, perhaps. But there was also the deep satisfaction of discovering that, despite their reputation to the contrary, Dublin drivers, even in congested traffic, are really a friendly bunch after all.
Inventory at St. Cronan's Well. One string of Buddhist worry beads, one blue pottery nativity scene, one triad of Hindu gods wearing two blue miraculous medals, one tiny brass bell on an orange ribbon, one silver whistle on an orange loop, one red velvet headband, one red crocheted heart with a pearl, one large limpet shell, one child's eraser, one baby's soother, two gents' striped handkerchiefs, assorted ribbons, hair ties, bracelets, an underwater glitter of coins. And beside the clean U-shaped stone well in sunshine, hips on a wild rosebush, haws on a hawthorn, slows on a blackthorn, winged seeds on a sycamore, a stone chats and a blackbird's song, tangled in the brambles, a stone cairn nearby, and a white cup with a blue rim hung head high on an ash branch. Was thirst ever so candid? Was hope ever so manifest? Was a source ever so honoured? Were banners ever lifted so high in life's bright battle with illness, love's long debate with oblivion?
On this morning's selection of new and recent archive miscellany scripts, we heard The Seal Whisperer by Michael Cullen, The Rice Workers of Vercelli by William Wall, Lambay's Lordship by Nollig Roan. The Birdman was by Michael Hilliard Murphy. Transporting Bees in Dublin by Kevin Connolly. And Inventory at St. Cronan's Well, a poem by Moya Cannon. The music was Selkie Song by True. Bella Ciao, sung by Giovanna Daffini. Lambé by The Finns. Reflections of My Life by Marmalade. And Rimsky-Korsakov's Flight of the Bumblebee, played by the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Neville Marriner. And William Wall has a new novel out. It's called Writers Anonymous, and it's published by New Island. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.